The first mass-produced plug-in electric cars sold in the United States are set to hit auto showrooms by the end of this year. The Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt already have tens of thousands of pre-orders, so this type of car appears to be ready to move beyond the domain of tech hobbyists and environmentalists. Still, there are plenty of questions about their feasibility. Here's Andrea Kissick of member station KQED in San Francisco.
I have never been into cars. I don't know an oil filter from an air filter. But my 15-year-old Honda is on its last legs, and recently I've been curious about alternative fuels. So, with electric cars around the corner, my dream of green motoring suddenly seems possible.
Okay, already it looks different.
I spent some time behind the wheel of a shiny new, powder blue, all-electric Nissan Leaf, an aerodynamic four-door hatchback with a range of 100 miles. Paul Haasen from Nissan joins me for a test drive outside the San Francisco Giants ballpark.
You're going to want to turn on the car by stepping on the brake.
It's roomy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised because I'm like almost 5'10", and oftentimes in these small cars, I'm not comfortable.
You'll find that the rear seat is equally as roomy.
As Haasen launches into car salesman speak, I search for the brake.
This is the brake, the big
yes,
one.
Yes, yes.
And this is the gas pedal.
Yes.
Oh, wait, you don't call it the gas pedal. What would you call it? The power?
It'd be an accelerator pedal.
The dashboard overwhelms me with a confusing array of digital displays. There's some kind of interactive bar graph that I think is supposed to tell me when I'm about to run out of juice. And a satellite map of charging stations I can use. Not very many of them at this point. More on that later. After several attempts to start the car...
Whoops, I hit it twice. That was too fast. Push it in, push my brake on.
You have to
I'm already can't even get this.
You have to depress the brake.
I finally managed to start the car, and much like hybrids, I can't really hear anything. As we drive up over the Bay Bridge toward Berkeley, I notice a blind spot because of the small back window. Otherwise, I find my excitement building as the car zooms along.
So one of the things is this car goes fast. I mean, when you were talking, I noticed I was 72 miles an hour. I didn't even know it.
Yep.
I mean, wow.
Top speed is 90 miles per hour.
I could get a ticket in this car. It's a wild feeling driving without a tailpipe. The downside, instead of a gas tank, which might run an average of 300 miles, a big lithium-ion battery pack sits under the car. One charge only lasts for about 100 miles. I need to figure out how to get around with this kind of limited range. So I check in with car guru Carl Brower, an editor at Edmunds.com.
You have to probably have a secondary vehicle that you know is a backup that you can utilize.
What? I need to buy two cars? Isn't there something else I can do?
What people need to do is get better about planning and not assuming that they can just go out and run four different errands coming back and forth each time.
I'm also going to have to think about how I use my radio, heater, wipers. They can all run a battery down pretty quickly. And that's where the competition thinks it has an advantage. GM's new midsize Chevy Volt is a hybrid, yes, but a new type of hybrid, a plug-in. It will go 40 miles on pure battery power, but then, when that juice runs out, it can go another 300 miles on gas power. GM couldn't make a Volt available for me to test drive, but at a little more than $33,000 after federal tax credits, the car is just too expensive for me. I asked GM's Shad Balk, why the high price tag?
I don't believe the Volt is so expensive. I mean, it's an electric car that can be your only car. So the value that you get out of this car is a pretty good deal.
But Nissan's all-electric Leaf is just $20,000 after state and federal tax credits. That's just more affordable. And it would get me one of California's coveted carpool stickers for low-emission vehicles. But one thing still haunts me, that fancy satellite map on the Nissan Leaf dashboard, showing less than a handful of charging stations out there. I don't want to run out of juice and be stranded by the side of the road. Even driving solo in the Diamond Lane isn't worth that. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Kissick.
And tomorrow, Andrea goes in search of a battery charge.
Now to talk through the week in politics, we're joined by our regular Friday duo, David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. Welcome to you both.
Good to be with you.
I want to start you off where Tom Bowman just left us, with the departure of General Jones as National Security Advisor. David, let me start with you. How do you rate his tenure?
He was a bit of a mismatch. You know, most people, if you go in the White House, most people are in love with the president. They dream about him. They write poems about him. They have little heart signs in their notebooks about him. And so they want to serve him. Jones never really gave off that aura. And that's pretty bad for a national security advisor. You got to wake up in the morning and say, what can I do today to make my president's life easier? And the successful ones have done that and have paid close attention to that job and have spent, put in the hours, 12, 14, 17 hours a day doing that. He never really fit into that model, and he never really fit into the culture of debate. So I think it became evident months and months ago that Obama was going to Donilon, even has been going to Donilon because he just felt more comfortable with him.
EJ, we've heard rumors that General Jones's departure was coming, but it seems to have come maybe a little bit sooner than some people were expecting. What do you think is the backstory?
Well, you know, I should disclose that when I moved to Washington 24 years ago, Tom Donilon was the first person I met back in the day when he was, not to use Mike McCurry's language, a political operative. Mm. And he's a very smart political operative. And I got to say, from the first months of the administration, I had a feeling this switch was going to happen. It was only a matter of when. And there are a couple of factors there. One is that Tom Donilon spent a lot of time with Barack Obama during debate preparation. And that's a very intense period. And you either get to like somebody or you get to not like somebody in that period. And Obama took a liking to him. Secondly, he's had a kind of channel with the State Department through the Deputy Secretary of State, Jim Steinberg. They have worked together for years on campaigns when Democrats are out of power on foreign policy issues. That helped prevent tensions between Secretary of State Clinton and the president. And it gave Donilon, I think, some extra power. So I thought this was eventually going to happen, and now it has.
And now it has. Well, we learned one interesting bit of trivia about Donilon today, which is that he gets through the day thanks to, quote, seemingly limitless quantities of Diet Coke.
That's
true. The president
gave
us that news today.
An untold scandal in the administration because Larry Summers also uses a lot of Diet Coke. So there's a real addiction problem throughout the entire White House.
Well, setting aside possible addiction problems.
The administration's Coke problem, is that what you're talking about?
I mean, one thing he does not bring to the table is military experience. General Jones obviously had that in spades. Does it matter in the 21st century for a national security advisor to have had some military experience under their belt?
Well, I think Henry Kissinger would say it's not a big problem. Mm-hmm. I think we've always had
Rice.
A mixture of foreign policy advisors, some out of the military, some not. And I think that's a good thing. You need some of both.
David, this word of Jones's departure comes just a week after Rahm Emanuel, President Obama's chief of staff, announced he's leaving. Last month came word that a couple of his top economic advisors, Christina Romer and Larry Summers, were stepping aside. Is this an unusual amount of turnover for a president before the two-year mark in his presidency, before even the midterm elections?
Yeah, I actually don't think so. Some of the people had to leave. Larry Summers had to leave because of a Harvard rule. Rahm Emanuel had to leave because destiny called him back to Chicago. And I would say if some people have a sense that there's a White House in disarray, they're beaten down in the polls, they just don't feel good, the rats are jumping the ship. I find that's not true. In my conversations with people in the White House, their mood is fine. They're not too pleased about Washington these days and the city they happen to live in. But within the White House, I don't detect any upsurge in disarray or down attitudes or infighting. So I think a lot of this is just, by and large, it's either a couple people they were unhappy with, but mostly it's just an accumulation of circumstance, not a sign of anything deeper.
Well, let me ask you both about another challenge the president's facing, and of course the economy would be front and center. We had new unemployment numbers out today showing the economy still really struggling to create jobs. This new report showing the economy lost 95,000 jobs in September. Not a very encouraging picture for the president, and that's the last unemployment report we're going to have before the elections next month. What does this mean for members of Congress out trying to figure out how to spend this on the campaign trail?
Well, in campaign terms, the Democrats, the administration, have been hoping for months and months of, say, 200,000 jobs a month, and they haven't gotten that. But I think it's really interesting if you split these numbers up. Our supposedly socialist president has presided over 9 straight months of private sector job growth. We had 63,000 new private sector jobs. Where the losses were in government employment, not just from the census jobs disappearing. Local governments lost 76,000 jobs. And this is something David and I have disagreed on for months. I think that it's very clear that you needed more stimulus, particularly in the form of help to state and local governments. They're in fiscal crisis. They are laying off people. And in many cases, they're also raising taxes. This is not a good thing to do for the economy. And so I think what you're going to see is people saying, Obama's stimulus didn't work in campaign terms. Stimulus wasn't big enough, but it actually did a lot for us as far as it went. And what's really hurting us now are the anti-stimulative policies as things like aid to state and local governments get blocked by the Republicans in Congress.
David, what's your take?
I might take a little different tact. I think what happened is that over the last 20 years, we went on this huge debt binge. And if you look at the debt charts, public debt, private debt, it's just like climbing a mountain. And then we had the crisis, and now we're getting out of that debt. And so savings rates have begun to jump. Corporations are beginning to store away some money. And the effect of this in the public sector is that states are bringing their budgets into balance, and that's leading to unemployment. But corporations and individuals are beginning to save a little. And we just have to do that. And there's no short-term solution to that problem. We have to get to a point where our fiscal situation at home and in the states are at some sort of sustainable level, and that means we're going to have slow growth for a long period, but there is no shortcut out of that problem. We went on a three-decade binge.
But if you're looking at the state and local governments, we're not talking here about they're just getting rid of debt and coming to some balance. I mean, they're making very deep cuts and the tax increases. And, conservatives shouldn't very much the fact that state and local governments are having to raise taxes. And so I think there is still a role to get this thing moving quicker.
EJ, one more topic for you on the campaign trail. This controversy over funding for U.S. Chamber of Commerce ads. The allegation is the chamber is using foreign money to pay for its ads. The chamber denies it. What should we make of it?
The problem is there's no way of knowing whether or not the chamber is telling the truth or whether it is technically telling the truth, but foreign money coming in through memberships from foreign entities, it is sort of indirectly mixed in. And I think this becomes a big deal. There is an enormous amount of outside advertising financed by wealthy conservatives and now, thanks to that terrible Citizens United decision, corporations. I was down in Danville, Virginia, in Tom Perriello's district, and you look at the morning shows and was just bombarded with ads. I think this is going to become a big issue because people are going to ask, why are these people spending all this money to influence this election? What do they want to buy out of it?
All right. Thank you very much. That's EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
I'm Robert Siegel. And first this hour, the economy, as measured by the latest jobs report. In September, 95,000 jobs were lost. Unemployment remained at 9.6%. But while public sector hiring was down last month, the private sector added jobs, as NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Going into the midterm elections, voters, of course, are focused on the economy. Unemployment has been above 9% for more than a year. About 15 million people looking for a job can't find one. And everybody wants to see the country gaining jobs, not losing them. So the headline here, down 95,000 jobs, is probably not going to inspire much hope.
The initial reaction was one of slight shock, if you will, about how big the drop was.
Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at the forecasting firm IHS Global Insight. He says after digging into the report, though, it's actually not as bad as it sounds.
We looked at it carefully and realized most of that was because of the census workers, 77,000 census workers being laid off.
Those job losses are just a one-time fluke that skews the data and makes it look worse than it is. Of course, the whole jobs report wasn't just a fluke in the data. A surprising number of teachers actually got laid off last month. That's just one sign of how stretched state and local governments are. But when you look at private sector jobs, there we actually saw some job growth. And that's what President Obama highlighted today when he spoke at a small business in Maryland.
This morning, we learned that in the month of September, our economy gained 64,000 jobs in the private sector. In July and August, private sector job numbers were revised upwards. So we've now seen 9 straight months of private sector job growth.
Nariman Baravesh agrees that is moving in the right direction, but he says we're still not seeing that many private sector jobs added. He says over the past few months, we've averaged around 100,000 new jobs a month, when he'd like to be seeing two or three times that number every month. You can see this very gradual economic recovery underway on the factory floor at F.H. Peterson Machine Corporation outside Boston. The family business employs about 60 people, and like many other machine shops scattered across New England, it makes all sorts of metal parts.
Just what I'm looking at here, I can see food processing equipment, a prototype part for the Air Force that goes into a fuselage of an airplane.
Mark Marullo is one of the owners. He's standing near a big machine that's spinning and cutting a 2-foot-wide metal part for a nuclear reactor. With work drying up during the recession, Marullo's employees here had their hours cut back very sharply.
So guys that would normally be working 50, 55, sometimes 60 hours a week, all of a sudden were cut down to 32 hours on straight time and taking a day off a week. So it was a big hit.
But Marullo says in recent months, business has been picking up. Most of his workers are back to 40 hours a week. And while he's not hiring right now, he says things are definitely looking better.
I was in New York last week at a trade show, and the feeling down there, we talked to people, you know, from all over the East Coast, some people from the Midwest, and everybody's optimistic that business has definitely improved in the last 6 months.
It's just that so far, that optimism isn't translating into companies hiring a lot more workers.
We were down in the dump so low, people really want to make sure that it's staying that way before they put people on. And if they need three or four, I think they'll put on one and wait a little while more.
So the economy does still appear to be on the mend. It's just a very slow and cautious mend. And as we head into the midterm elections, a big question for incumbent politicians is whether that will be enough to satisfy voters who, of course, would like to see the economy improving faster than it is. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
This is a weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The latest unemployment report shows the jobless rate is basically stuck where it has been, and that's not good news. The private sector added fewer jobs than economists expected, and government jobs disappeared. The jobs report released yesterday is the last one before November's midterm elections. NPR's White House correspondent Ari Shapiro reports on how elected officials are dealing with it.
The unemployment report prompted dueling speeches at small businesses 500 miles apart from each other. In Maryland, President Obama visited a concrete products company.
Yeah, these are the guys that build serious stuff. Concrete blocks, bricks for walls that are thick, difficult to move, and can stop anything in their path. The way I feel about Congress sometimes.
Congressman John Boehner is proud to have obstructed the president's agenda. He hopes to be speaker if Republicans take back the House in 3 weeks. Yesterday, Boehner gave a speech of his own at a small business in his home district.
The pink slips shouldn't be going to workers here in Ohio. They should be going to the members of President Obama's economic team.
Both men talked a lot about how small businesses are struggling in this economy, but they gave utterly different views. First, President Obama argued that Republicans stood in the way of government programs that would give small businesses easier access to cash.
Thousands of small business owners across America had been waiting for months for this bill to pass, for the loans and tax cuts they've badly needed to grow their businesses and hire new employees. Unfortunately, it was held up all summer by a partisan minority until a few courageous Republican senators put politics aside.
But back in Ohio, Congressman Boehner said the answer is for government to get out of the way and stop spending taxpayer money on ineffective programs.
Your government is out of control. Do you have to accept it? Do you have,
no.
Do you have to take it?
No.
Hell no, you don't!
Yesterday's numbers show that unemployment has now been above 9.5% for 14 months. That's longer than any time since the 1930s.
Everybody knows this hole's the deepest since 1929, and I think that just confirms what people knew.
This is Austin Goolsbee, the new chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers. While Mr. Obama was speaking in Maryland, Goolsbee was at the White House trying to put the unemployment numbers in context.
All you can do is start at the bottom and work your way out, and he clearly came in at the bottom, and we're just trying to slowly work our way out of this. It will succeed.
President Obama cannot be voted out of office in November, but Democrats across the country are at risk. Members of both parties are making the same argument in TV and radio ads. I deserve to be in office because I can create jobs.
What's at stake in this election? Jobs.
We need experienced job creators in Washington, not more job killers.
Reduce taxes for workers and job-creating businesses.
Create clean energy jobs that can't be outsourced.
Because the economy should be job one.
Businesses are coming back, slowly. In September, the private sector added 64,000 jobs, which is about average for the last 9 months. Unfortunately, that's not nearly enough to get us out of this hole, says senior economist Robert Dye of the PNC Financial Services Group.
Well, we'd like to see, you know, consistent monthly gains of 150,000 to 200,000 per month to really bring the unemployment rate down in a meaningful way.
That means job growth needs to more than double, and until it does, Dye says, people in office will be voted out.
A bad economy, and I think a 9.6% unemployment rate qualifies as a bad economy, going into an election is bad news for incumbents. It doesn't matter what party you're in. If you're an incumbent in this election, watch out.
Both parties have known for a while that a bad economy makes things tough for incumbents, and most of those incumbents are Democrats. Now they know for certain that things will not get better before Election Day. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.